Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
An alternative to alternatives. One approach, multi-asset and unbenchmarked. That's the strapline of Ruffer Investment Management, who describes themselves as simply managing a global absolute return strategy, same since 1994. Now, there's a lot in those sentences, from unbenchmarked to an alternative to alternatives, and to explain and maybe justify some of those aspirations, I'm really pleased to have Hamish Bailey with me today. Hamish is a long-term partner and stalwart of Ruffer. He's lead manager of the Ruffer Investment Company, which is listed on the London Stock Exchange, and also responsible for their Scottish office. So Hamish, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I have to say, I'm a big fan of the podcast, having listened to some of your excellent guests before, and there's more than a whiff of imposter syndrome from this end of the line.
Well, that probably with the presenter as well. I know you're in Edinburgh today and I'm in London. Now, is it true that one of your ancestors founded Bailey Gifford, hence the Bailey in your name, or is that apocryphal?
Wow, you've done your research. That is true. And when I moved up to Edinburgh, I was actually given a copy of 100 Years of Investing at Bailey Gifford by Richard Burns, which he marked the page that pointed this out, and also that Augustus was a bit of a charlatan, which he was quite quick to point out to me. So he certainly wasn't the brains of the operation.
So let's just step back to your education. Were you brought up in Scotland, and from where do you really herald?
Sure. I grew up in the north of Scotland, in Invernessshire, and then departed to Ireland, where I studied at Trinity College Dublin. And then I spent the first part of my career in London and came back to Scotland about 10 years ago. So a bit of a round trip.
So actually, you are our second guest that studied at Trinity. We had David Roach, Morgan Stanley's former global strategist, who was on, who has clearly predated you by some time. But you studied classical civilization and French. Now, that isn't an obvious segue into investment management. Just tell me what you were thinking.
So I was given a great piece of advice by someone before I went to university, and that was, when you join the financial services sector, which is what I wanted to do, they will treat you as though you have no knowledge whatsoever. You will sit the same exams, whether you have an economics degree or none. And so go and do something different at university, and then you will start from scratch. And that was a great bit of advice. And yes, I studied classics and French, and I can't say it's been hugely useful to my career, but it's been a great experience in life.
And probably made you a significantly richer individual in terms of sitting next to you and discussing things. But anyway, Let's talk about the world of investing. And were you straight into Ruffer, or did you have several steps before you arrived there?
I was straight into Ruffer. It's quite unusual these days. I mean, that was my first job. I think I know one other person at Allen & Overy of my vintage who's still in his first job. So it's quite unusual. And I joined the company when it was very small and have watched it grow. So yeah, first job, very short CV. That's me.
Let's just start with that question, because you join Ruffer when they have about 30 employees, and today I believe they have over 300 and you manage over $25 billion as an organization. So I guess the first question is, how different is it today?
So I think there are two parts there. One is the external environment and the other is the internal one. The external environment is very different, because what we did back in 1994, I joined in 2002, but even then was quite a lonely place to be. I mean, we describe ourselves now as absolute return investors, but that didn't really exist back then. There were perhaps a few hedge funds who had a similar philosophy to us, but it wasn't a mainstream investment approach. Certainly when you were talking to people, the first thing was to convince them that pursuing an unbenchmarked approach, a market neutral approach, was a good thing to do. And secondly, you had to convince them that Ruffer was the right place to do that. Now, that has obviously changed beyond all recognition. And what we do now is, you know, there are lots of other people doing a similar thing. They may go about it differently, but the philosophy of not being tied to a benchmark is quite commonplace now. So that was externally. I think internally, clearly, yes, growing from 30 employees to 350, where we are just now, business has changed a lot and we've had to adapt with that. But I do think we still feel like a relatively small business. And I think that's a very positive thing. I think we've stayed true to our DNA, and the feel within the business is very similar to what it was back then. And the final thing is, I think our proximity to our clients is also unchanged. We insist that everyone managing money has contact directly with the people whose money it is. And that's something we insist both internally and with our clients. And I think that keeps you honest. You really feel the sense of responsibility very keenly.
And so you've been with Ruffer since 2004. And just tell me a little bit about what keeps you motivated and keeps you coming into the office every day.
Sure. 2002, actually. But given that I was on the photocopier for the first 2 years, we'll ignore that. What keeps me coming in? Well, I think you've got to have a deep sense of belief in what you do, don't you? I mean, this is not something you can do for this long if you don't truly believe in what you're doing. I think on top of that, duty. We carry a huge responsibility in looking after our clients, and we wear that with pride. Fun, absolutely. We take what we do very seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. I think that's a nice ingredient. And then, of course, it's the people around you, isn't it? There's an extraordinary mix of talent around us, both within the business and outside, that you get exposure to. And being at the coalface of investing, you know, we're not subletting our responsibilities. We're actually investing people's money. You know, you feel that responsibility very keenly, and I think that's tremendously motivating.
Now, you mentioned the photocopier, but I think I'd also heard a story about your career being enhanced close to the photocopier. So maybe you can expand on that.
When I started at Ruffer, I mean, I really came in straight out of university, and no one knew me. The key there is just not to be noticed, isn't it? Just don't do anything wrong and keep your head down and get on with things. I did this really well for a couple of months and no one knew who I was. And before I started at Ruffer, I'd spent a long time speaking to people. It was the depths of a bear market. And so I'd really cast my net very wide trying to get advice from people. And anyway, the day came where I was summoned into the conference room, because there was an important potential investor sitting there and some papers were needed. And I was told, take these papers, walk into the room, do not make eye contact with anyone, put the papers in, down, and walk out. And I followed that to the letter. And but I was only halfway back to the door when a voice from the other end of the room said, Hamish. And sure enough, it was one of the potential investor was one of the people that I'd sort of been referred to in my casting my net wide. And anyway, Jonathan Ruffer thought this was incredibly amusing that the photocopier boy was known to this potential investor. And well, the rest, as they say, is history.
So let's dive into the whole investment pool and looking at Ruffer's track record, your core fund has compounded at 9% over 26 years with lower volatility than that of your peers. And I think you write that your clients have typically made money in good markets, have been sheltered from market crises. I'm going to talk about some of the components in a minute, but let's just start with this clear statement that you have had, which is no benchmark. And my question is, with no benchmark, how do you set expectations?
So no benchmark is partly true. We do set an investment objective. So firstly, to preserve capital in any 12-month period, and secondly, to do better than cash on deposit. Now, back when we set that in 1994 and afterwards, you were talking about a mid-single digit return there. So for cash, now clearly cash rates have come down, but I think the primary focus is on capital preservation. So I think what our investors should expect is firstly, regardless of the market conditions, at the very least, we protect their capital and then we make a return on top of that.
So you write about safety, and I quote your materials, which say success can only be achieved by investing in a portfolio to take risk and by so arranging it that while each element often has substantial risk, the makeup of the whole has a robustness of balance such that the uncertainties that unfold allow the portfolio to make a positive return. Now, I know you're going to explain that, but as I read that and thought about the various episodes in investing over the long time that I've been doing this, we know that at points of crisis, correlations converge sharply towards one of all sorts of assets, and different epochs usher in very different behaviors of different assets. And I'm talking about what we saw in the 50s and 60s, etc. So how do you think about that? And is it realistic to believe that you can protect capital given you own risk assets on a one-year view?
I think what's unrealistic to expect that you can call the market correctly the whole time. So if you accept that and you still want to protect people's capital the whole time, then you need to build an investment process that will be robust regardless of the conditions that are thrown at you. So I think over that 26-year period, there are plenty of times in that where we've called market direction incorrectly, but our investment process has seen us through that and allowed us to, at the very least, protect capital, but hopefully make money as well. I think there are always places to hide in a crisis. I think that was certainly easier in the past. We think sort of pre-financial crisis than your conventional assets, like we use the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen, conventional government bonds. They all gave you the protection you need. I think that has become much more challenging in a low interest rate environment, but you can still find protection in unconventional assets. So we do use more derivative protection and other unconventional protection than we did in the past. The same thing is true. You want to own the assets that people panic into in a crisis. So cash is not one of those things, because cash doesn't go up in value the more liquidity that comes at it. The Swiss franc was a great example pre-financial crisis, where there'd been a huge carry trade out of the Swiss franc and into other, the Hungarian forint was a primary beneficiary of that. And what you knew is that when people had to repay that leverage, pay it down, then the Swiss franc would go up. And that's what's happened. So if you can find these places, then they can go up a lot in a crisis. And that means it can offset what you'll probably be losing elsewhere in, I agree, assets that weren't previously correlated but become so.
Yes, I think you're a little unusual in that over the years you have chosen currency blocks as part of that diversification. As I mentioned to you in our earlier conversation, I was on the Great Ormond Street Hospital Investment Committee and we had allocated to you, and I saw that. But do you think right now that whereas the Swiss franc was being used to fund speculative transactions and the yen to a certain extent, do you think that come the crisis that may or may not unfold, which we're going to come back to in a minute, that there are such obvious safe haven currencies?
I think that's absolutely correct. And that is reflected actually in our currency allocation, where we have a very high proportion in our base currency at the moment, be that US dollar, euro or sterling for our UK investors. So yes, I don't think currencies at the moment are the easy call that they have been as a protective asset in the past.
Well, I know central to your thinking is the inflation dilemma. We've talked quite a bit about it at the Money Maze podcast, and I'm perhaps guilty of harking about it quite a lot. So it's very nice to have somebody else who can do it now. But inflation is the silent killer of our purchasing power. and it's upon us right now. And I know you have some specific building blocks to try and counter that gold index linked. So maybe just take me through how you're approaching this inflation challenge.
Yeah, it's obviously the sort of topic du jour, isn't it? I mean, I'd probably start by saying that this is a major concern for us at the moment. And as you rightly identify, it's something that can have a massive impact on the spending power of your investors' capital. So, but it's not always the way. I mean, for much of Ruffer's history, we were more in the deflation camp. But we do feel at the moment that this is a big enough risk that we really need to do something, both to protect our investors, but also to create an opportunity there as well. So the background to this, I think, is quite instructive that even pre-COVID, we'd seen a huge buildup of debt in Western economies. And that wasn't causing huge problems with very low levels of interest rates. But at some point, that would start to bite if it continued to grow at the previous rate. Now, what COVID has done is obviously been a sort of massive escalation in the rate of growth in debt as a size of a proportion of the economy. And so this problem has become more immediate. Now, sure, the cost of servicing that debt is still very low at the moment. But if we take it as a sort of premise that at some point this chicken comes home to roost and has to be dealt with, then you think, well, what are the ways that this can be dealt with? And the UK post First World War went hard down the austerity approach, and the medicine worked, but it almost killed the patient. And I think nowadays austerity is politically off the menu. It's not politically palatable. So if you then look at the other options for repaying debt, you've got economic growth, tax that growth, pay down debt that way. That is a possibility. I think the US did that pretty successfully in the mid to late 30s by funding the war effort. But it's very unusual if you look back in history for that to have been a solution to a debt overhang. So the third, and probably four, the third would be an outright default, which no economy in control of its own currency really needs to go down. And the fourth, of course, is inflation, and something that you will see throughout history appears. And we think that's the most likely route to take now. So a long preamble to your question, if you accept that and accept that we're going into an environment of higher inflation volatility, then what do you do with that? Well, the things that you can take off the menu pretty quickly are cash and cash proxies. So think conventional bonds, because they get savaged. Look at 30-year treasuries, US treasuries. In the 35 years up to 1981, they lost about 80% of their value. I think the number was about 97% in the UK. So that is not the place you want to be for an environment where inflation is running significantly ahead of interest rates. Equities, that's the stalwart. That's what a lot of people put their faith in, because companies have pricing power. I think that's true. But if you look at many inflationary episodes, what hurts you more is actually the derating of equities. So you may be invested in a great business that has the ability to maintain its top line, maybe even it maintains its bottom line as well. But if the market lowers the PE that it will assign to that business, then investors are going to lose money. Where we sit is we have a sizable allocation to index-linked bonds, so inflation-linked bonds, primarily in the UK and the US. And we also have an allocation to gold, about 7% in gold. Gold obviously has a track record. You can look back in previous inflationary episodes, right back to Roman times, to see how that fares. Index-linked bonds have a much shorter history. They were really issued in reaction to the 1970s and the inflation of the 1970s. So there's no real test case for index-linked bonds. But when I said earlier, we like to own assets that people panic into, I think index-linked bonds could be exactly that.
So let's just stay with index linkers. There's some strange things going on. One portfolio manager I was talking to raised the question, why are current 10-year gilt BREC even so high? I think the index link gilt needs RPI of 4% when tips in the US only needed to be 2.5%.
So the UK has a history of higher inflation than the US. So it's quite common for UK linkers to trade with a higher break even than the US. I mean, if you think about that in currency terms, sterling is a minnow in global currency markets, so it can get knocked around a lot more, which means higher inflation volatility in the UK. So that's the sort of permanent feature of both markets. But if we're talking about here about a debasement of people's spending power, a debasement of paper currencies, then I think that applies equally to the UK and the US.
And I think that real yield on the long end its length is at nearly -3.5%.
Yeah, so almost as expensive as they've ever been. But don't forget, their history only goes back to the early 1980s. So what is fascinating at the moment, I think, is the ability for central banks to raise interest rates is quite limited. You saw this in the last budget, didn't you, when Sunak was challenged on the amount of debt the UK was carrying. He said, well, I'm not worried about the amount of UK debt, I'm worried about the cost of that debt. And quite right, he was saying, look, the cost of government borrowing at the moment is very low. If that started to creep up, then that would be something to be worried about. And what that says to me is that there's very little ability for the Bank of England or the Fed to push up interest rates. And I think we've seen that in the last 12 months where inflation has been rising. And we've had this chorus of, don't worry, it's transitory. And that is only now, we're speaking in December, it's only now just starting to recede, and Powell has accepted that it may last longer than anticipated. And so now we reach a really interesting point in markets where the question of, are central banks willing to tackle inflation? And part two is, are they able to? And that we will see in the coming months.
So back to gold, a 7% allocation is what I would term a proper allocation. I think sometimes allocators believe that they're making steps in the right direction with very, very minuscule 1% to 2% allocations, which we know in the scheme of things really don't move the needle. But as I read one of your reports, maybe you weren't the author of it, it talked about the importance of gold. And then there was this comment, despite mounting pressure from Bitcoin. And I said to myself, are they serious? And I know you as a group, what I might call traded Bitcoin for a while, but just explain to me how you believe Bitcoin could be a serious competitor to gold, please.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the jury is out on this. The question came in the context of why has gold done nothing in the last 12 months when we've got high inflation, we've got low interest rates, that tends to be very good in gold. We've got sort of faith in central banks and government. I would argue it's pretty low at the moment. That should be good at gold. So why hasn't it done more? And I think part of it is expectations that inflation will recede, which we disagree with. But the other part is a possibility that maybe people are turning to a digital form of gold. So if you think what gold is, it's hopefully a store of value. And it's got, you know, 2,500 years, 3,000 years of acting like that. So question, could cryptocurrency perform that role? There's a finite amount that can be issued. If you're looking at it, let's take Bitcoin. It sits outside the monetary system, so it can't be debased by governments and central banks. And so through that prism, there are quite interesting parallels. And that was the reason that we made an allocation last November 2020. And as you say, we no longer hold that, and we made a good return in it through to April when we sold out. The other strand to our argument was institutional adoption, which we felt was coming. That came an awful lot quicker than we thought would be the case. It happened in a matter of months rather than years. And there was also quite a lot of leveraged activity and quite a lot of heat in an asset that we were holding as a protective asset. So that was another reason for selling.
So I note that while some people in search of inflation own and are supporters of infrastructure equities, I don't think that's something that you as a group are particularly keen on. And so maybe just help me understand that view.
I think the attraction of infrastructure is the sort of bond proxy argument. It's an unvolatile asset. If you've got an inflation linkage in your contract, then it's got the indexation as well. And interesting concept, my concern would be the counterparty risk. So quite often these things are structured around a government contract. Now, could the government renege on the index-linked agreement on an index-linked bond? Yes, but very, very difficult to, because that could undermine confidence in the whole gilt market. Could they renege on it on a hospital in the southeast of England when the indexation is benefiting investors? I think that would be quite easy to do. And there's plenty of history of that, particularly in the UK, of that happening in the past. To come back to what we said earlier, you know, in a crisis, you want to be not just in a lifeboat, but in the one that you really think is the one that's going to stand up. There's no point in jumping into the lifeboat that's got lots of holes in it.
You have been hinting at this, but let's talk about the changing weather system. And I think your words in the report were that sky is about to change and the central message for investors that we're going to invert the last period and markets will grind lower and lower, punctuated by rallies of prodigious strength. So it was quite refreshing to read somebody who had quite a bearish take on the world. Just unpick that.
I mean, if you think about our job, it's to keep people safe. So we're always asking the question of what could go wrong? How could we lose money? And then we try and position ourselves to protect and grow our investors' funds on that basis. The other thing that's involved in doing this job is looking for the tectonic shifts in markets. So you have to look a long way, look at the horizon and see what you think is coming down the line. That's quite a difficult thing to do because A, you've got to try and spot these tectonic shifts, which is not necessarily that easy. But secondly, the timing of those changes is completely unknowable. So you have to invest in a way that even if you've taken a position that something is changing, you've got to accept that that may happen in the next 12 months or it may happen in 5 years or 10 years. So the regime change that we see happening now centers around the correlation between different assets and how that might change in a world of higher inflation. And the key thing here is really between bonds and equities. So if you look back over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a very helpful negative correlation between bonds and equities, which our industry has profited enormously from, and I'd say our business has as well. If you look back further than that, actually, it's much more common for bonds and equities, government bonds and equities, to be positively correlated. And we think we're going back into a world where they could be positively correlated. So if you're holding a fixed income instrument that probably has a very low yield on it and it no longer has that negative correlation to equities, then I think it's a very fair question. Why bother? So that regime shift is coming. We think it'll be driven by greater volatility in inflation. And that's why we hold some of the assets we've described here. I mean, I should also make the point that we need to think about, well, what if that's wrong? What if actually we're heading into a deeply deflationary environment? What if there's a shock to markets that no one saw coming? And we need to be positioned for that as well. And that's where some of the unconventional protection comes into play.
Talking about, as you did earlier on, the derating that occurs in inflation, sitting here in the home market, you've got a UK equity market that has been substantially derated courtesy of a number of things really over the last, 15 years. I didn't detect, looking at your allocations, that you had what one might call an oversized allocation to the UK, UK equities as opposed to debt. Is that right?
We do have the highest position in UK equities that we've had for many years. It's about 20% at the moment, which is a big overweight in a global context. That's mostly driven from a value perspective. That's where we're finding the best value. I don't think we're alone in that. You just look at the amount of private equity M&A activity in the UK is evidence that there is a sort of double discount there, isn't there, from the nature of the UK market, plus Brexit still hanging over the economy. So yeah, it's being a sort of happy hunting ground for us at the moment, but that's a kind of snapshot in time. It's not normal for us to have such a large position in the UK.
Right. And staying at a country level allocation, for some time you had very large allocations to Japan. And we know Japan probably 10 or 12 years ago got all the way back down to book value. It's clearly not so cheap now. I know your allocations have come down. But tell me about your allocations to Asia more broadly and even to China, where the risks are clear, but the valuation opportunity may equally be clear.
So just to fill in on the Japan story, I mean, we went into Japan in 2003 and built up a lot of expertise there. We spent a lot of time out there meeting companies. And it was driven by, yes, a valuation basis, but I think it was also a place that would really benefit from some, I'd say, reflation more than inflation. But if the global economy did well, then Japan was almost a warrant on that because it was cheap and it was, you know, it's a globalized market and the companies there would benefit from that. And then that gained some traction through 2003, 4, 5, but then wind the clock forward. And when Abe came to power, that was another great moment where a bit of wind was put into the sails of the Japanese stocks. So that was the background to Japan. It's a very investor-friendly market. Governance standards are more like the West. I mean, they're slightly different, but more like the West. When you start to go into China, that is clearly very different. I mean, we spend a lot of time looking at China. We don't have much invested there at the moment, but many of the companies that we hold will be hugely influenced by what goes on in China. But at the moment, we have very small allocation to Asia as a whole, and particularly to China. And we're not denying that there are opportunities, there are growth opportunities there, but particularly wearing a corporate governance hat, and we've seen this as sort of more interference from the government in Japan recently, that it's a place where we'd rather have our exposure indirectly than directly.
And then moving from country to sector, unless I'm mistaken, it appears you have quite a large allocation to big oil, which is a constant discussion around investment committees. And so I just wonder how you have, if that's right, have you felt about the valuation case versus the environmental concerns that maybe oversimplify the debate?
Yeah, I really like what you said earlier about gold, saying that in the first stage of inflation, actually, it's the commodities that do well rather than gold. And that was a view that we took 12 months ago. And we kept our gold position, but we thought, actually, if the inflation pressure is going to come because of strong demand, you know, people getting out of lockdown, maybe some supply constraints as well, then that would be very good for commodity stocks generally, but particularly for energy stocks. So that piques our interests. We do a lot of engagement with all the companies we invest in, and that's our approach to being responsible investors. We will use divestment if we need to, but it's a sort of tool of last resort, because once you've sold your shares, perhaps to someone less discerning than you, then you no longer have any influence. So we will engage with companies, and we've been particularly two largest energy holdings, Royal Dutch and BP. We've had very constructive conversations with those companies, and we're interested in how, firstly, you know, are they embracing the mood change in markets and the ESG risks to them? And I think we're well down that path. I think they recognize the risks of their business model. And so the second point is, okay, what are you going to do about it, and how do you manage this transition? And I think we're in the early stages of that. And what we really want to do as investors is to help encourage, I'll use both of those words, these companies to make that transition. And if it doesn't look like it's going to work financially, or management aren't prepared to do that, then divestment is a possibility.
I think that is a very pragmatic answer. As we think about this portfolio that the Ruffer team manage, we have the inflation protection assets, including a large exposure to linkers. We have the gold, we have equities with pretty important geographical tilts and sector tilt. But you also build in protection. And maybe you could just spend a minute or two explaining how that works.
I mean, Simon, you'll know in investment markets, lightning does sometimes strike from blue skies. And I guess COVID is the perfect example of that, isn't it? I can safely say that we did not see a pandemic coming, and yet our investment strategy held up and actually made money through the first quarter of last year. So we need, as I said earlier, to build something into our investment process that allows for these left tail events that may come from clear skies. So the way we do that is to carry protection of some form all the time. And the nature of that protection will be different depending on the market environment. So in the past, it's been more deflation focused. At the moment, it's quite inflation focused. We're quite worried about bond yields going up at the moment. So we hold interest rate protection that offsets some of the risk in our index link book. And we'll also hold just straight equity market protection through different ways. That might be index put options. Through COVID, we actually held volatility call options, which did very well in Q1 2020. So the nature of these insurance policies, if you want to put it that way, is that you deploy a small amount of premium into them that quite often will be a premium that is not needed. You know, the insurance policy is not needed. But if a big generational kind of change event comes, then it can be incredibly powerful because, firstly, it protects you through that crisis. But of course, the other part of that, and I think that's, again, what COVID has shown quite well, is that you can then monetize that, you can take your profits, and you can deploy it into bombed out assets. And if you look at the returns that the Ruffer strategy has generated over the years, most of that has actually come in the recovery from a crisis, not in the crisis itself. Because of course, in a year like 2009, 2020 or 2003, There are some fantastic opportunities out there, but there's no point going looking for those if your £100 has become 50. If your £100 is still 100 or it's 120, 130, then you're in a really strong position to capitalize on those opportunities. So I think that's something that we like to do. I mean, it's also something that I really encourage our investors to do, is to use Ruffer as a sort of diversifier, but also to use us opportunistically. If a really fantastic opportunity comes up when Ruffer is held up well and other investments have fallen, and that's the moment to use Ruffer to take advantage of those opportunities.
So let's move from the investing markets to the investment organization. And Ruffer was started by Jonathan Ruffer. He was associated with the firm's enormous success. When you have an inspirational founder who then moves slightly to the side of the track, tell me a little bit about the challenges that brings and how you and your colleagues have adapted.
I think the ownership structure of your organization is very important. I mean, that's got to be the starting point. We're a partnership, and Jonathan's charity actually has stake in that partnership. Now, that's tremendously helpful because it's a stable wicket to bat off, and you know that the founder's interest is going to live on after his involvement in the business. So that's something we set up a long time ago. The next thing I'd say is, in terms of transition, is start early. We're more than 10 years into our transition. It's probably one of the longest succession plans in history. I mean, Jonathan is still actively involved in the business. He's 3 days a week. The rest of the time he spends doing his philanthropic activities. We want to get the best out of him. So as well as start early, I'd say you want the founder focusing on things that others can't do, or invert that. You don't want him wasting lots of time on things that others can do. And I'm particularly thinking there about the running of the business. So for us, I think the most valuable things that our founder can do for us is keep us true to our origins, that DNA in the business. He's a very important part of that. And secondly, his sort of macroeconomic insights that really help the investment strategy, they are very valuable as well. The longer term thing we've been doing is to build a deep bench. And I think we now have that, 350 people in the firm. And something we've chosen to do is to look a lot internally. We have recruited externally where we think there's a good match, but I think quite often businesses miss the obvious option internally. So deep bench, start the transition earlier, and make sure you've got the right structure to make that transition.
And I suppose that leads me to ask the next question, is that Ruffer has grown very strongly in assets. They've performed very well. The enemy of some investment organizations is size. And I wonder whether you can just talk a little bit about your ambition and how you think you're going to manage what is often that very challenge.
Yeah, well, I think back to the shark here swimming in the water. Any business, growth is a really important part of keeping the business vibrant, keeping it alive. But I also agree with what you said, you know, many investment businesses fail when they scale up. I mean, I think at $25 billion US dollars, as you said, we're not a sort of muscle-bound organization that becomes an index hugger because we're so big that we can't differentiate. So we're definitely not at that size yet. But we do have ambitions to expand our business in the US, in Australia, in continental Europe, where we have a footprint at the moment, but we think there's a bigger opportunity there. I mean, liquidity is a really important thing for us. And well before the sort of Woodford days, we've been really focusing on liquidity. So I think awareness of the risk is a very important thing. I think what makes our lives slightly easier is that we are quite a simple organization. Our investment strategy is the same across all the money we manage. So that makes it very easy to manage risks like liquidity and concentration. And lastly, I think, is do you head down the route of groupthink, consensual, process-driven decision-making? We've maintained a very narrow leadership at the top of the investment side of the business. So alongside Jonathan Ruffer, Henry Maxey is our chief investment officer, and we've deliberately kept that very narrow. They've got lots of support beneath them, but if we want to make decisions quickly, we feel you don't want a huge committee trying to make that. And so a semi sort of benign dictatorship is actually very good, I think, in an investment business. And that's what we've tried to protect.
Yes, it was the late Barton Biggs, Morgan Stanley strategist, used to talk about the dangers of overpopulating your investment committee and democratizing it excessively. So my final question before I move to some more general closing ones is, tell me a little bit about the type of clients that you have and the type of clients you think are most suited to what you're doing.
So part of that question is a huge range is the answer, in that our origins are looking after high net worth individuals, but we have a big institutional pension fund business now. We look after big family offices. We look after a lot of charities as well. It's a very diverse client base in terms of the types of investor. But I think what they all share is that the money they allocate to Ruffer to invest is really important, that it is preserved. The spending power of that is preserved. Now, that could be an entrepreneur who's just sold his business, so he sort of passed go, collected his winnings, and now wants to go on and do something similar. But he thinks, I've banked that. That's my rainy day pot of money. So we have quite a lot of clients who think like that. In the charity space, charity receives an endowment. That's got to see it through its days forever. So it's very important that it's preserved and grows steadily on time to fund their activities. So, I mean, there are different types of client, but I think what they all share is that the money they allocate to us, it's quite important that they don't lose it.
Thank you. Now, I am told that you are a piper, that rare skill of being able to arrive at the bagpipes and entertain. And if you were to play your pipes at a dinner where you had two guests, what tune would you want to play and who would your guests be?
Wow, I didn't see that coming. Okay. which tune would I play is actually quite easy, because as I have got older, my memory, when you're piping, you don't have any music in front of you, so you have to memorize all the tunes you play. And so my repertoire has shrunk so far that nowadays I tend to just do weddings and funerals, and I tend to do more funerals and weddings, which means that Flowers of the Forest, which is a beautiful lament, would be about the only tune I could play, but would not be appropriate for dinner. But hopefully, because I'm choosing a Scotsman, he would really like this. And I would choose John Law. I'm a bit of a sort of a kind of hero worship John Law. And for those of your listeners who don't know about John Law, he was a Scotsman who is quite often cited as one of the causes of the French Revolution. He introduced France to paper money and promptly bankrupt the country, but it juries out as to whether that was his fault or not. My wife is French, so a Scotsman who managed to bankrupt France is pretty good in my book. But why would I choose him? Well, he was a mathematical genius. He had an incredible grasp of the sort of monetary system of France at the time, but also he had an unbelievable ability to get himself into trouble. I think there's quite a high likelihood that you would end dinner in a sort of pistols duel at dawn or something like that, or being sort of banished from the country. And I feel that probably quite exciting things would happen over dinner.
So my final question is, we have a lot of young people, students who listen to the Money Based podcast, and we always love to ask our guests if they would have any specific advice for people thinking about starting out in finance.
I would say put your energy into something or someone you truly believe in, and don't worry too much about the detail or over planning. If you really have your energy behind something and you believe in it, then the rest will hopefully fall into place. The other thing, slightly differently, that I'd say is, don't be afraid to say that you don't know the answer. I mean, that's something that's served me very well in my career, that we're not expected to know the answer to everything. And sometimes just saying, do you know what? I don't know the answer to that. I'll come back to you, I think really gains the respect of others.
Thank you, Hamish. Some terrific and sound advice there. And I have really enjoyed talking to you and understanding a little bit more about your investment approach. Two things are clear to me. One is that you as a firm are believers that some bad weather lies ahead that may be less transitory, to use a word at the moment, and possibly much less comfortable than many are used to. But as a firm, you're not afraid to take significant positions in assets that you believe offer potential protection from those storms and articulate those very clearly. And that last comment to youth about not overplanning is also very helpful in a world where everybody is perhaps a little bit too busy believing that a lot can be scheduled and planned, which is not typically how life works. So, Hamish, thank you so much for joining us today and for your thoughts and your time. Well, look forward to seeing you in London.
Thank you, Simon. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed. All references to Ruffa performance refer to Ruffa's representative portfolio, which shows the performance of an unconstrained, segregated model portfolio of £1 million set up in 1995 following Ruffa's investment approach. To give a balanced impression of performance, Ruffa's 12-monthly performance to December between 2017 and 2021 was 0.5%, -5.8%, 7%, 16.7%, and 8.9% respectively. Ruffa performance is described after deduction of all fees and management charges and on the basis of income being reinvested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The value of the shares and the income from them can go down as well as up, and you may not get back the full amount originally invested. The value of overseas investments will be influenced by the rate of exchange. For further information on Ruffa's performance, please see the performance page on Ruffa's website at ruffa.co.uk.